Titans rookie quarterback Zett Mettenberger tore an ACL last year, had some other off-field issues that caused him to slide down maybe a little farther than he would have or should have. He wants to slide to the top of the depth chart in Tennessee, and it's not a crowded depth chart with highly talented quarterbacks. You've got the oft-injured Jake Locker, Charlie Whitehurst, Ryan Wilson, et cetera, joining us now to break it all down as it relates to the Tennessee Titans, our good friend Jim Wyatt of the Nashville Tennessean. And let's start with that quarterback position, Zett Mettenberger. Is this just young guy being optimistic, or does he have a chance to be the week one starter without another injury to Jake Locker, actually winning the job fair and square in a competition?
Well, I like Mettenberger. He's a good kid, and that's kind of, you know, what he said in those comments here sounds similar to what he said, I guess, the day he was picked. And that's kind of been his theme along with Taylor Lewan's theme all the way through, that they came here to be a starter. I guess if they said anything else, that would send up, you know, raise some flags that these guys are not shooting for the top. But it's not realistic. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, I think Zett Mettenberger is going to have a hard time being the number two quarterback in week one, and I'll be shocked if he is. I mean, I think Jake Locker, there's no question Jake Locker is this team's starter unless he gets hurt. And Ken Whitenhunt's made no bones about it that Charlie Whitehurst was here, brought here to be a number two. And while so Zett Mettenberger's competing for the number third spot right now with Tyler Wilson. He should win that just because, like you said, he was a six-round draft pick. He probably would have been picked higher than that if not for some injury concerns and maybe some other issues he had surrounding him. But they have no certainly it would be a surprise to everyone in the building if he would even be unseating number two. But there's no way he's going to be the number one, barring an injury. That doesn't mean he can't get better. It doesn't mean he can't put himself in position to help himself moving forward. But I'm just being realistic here.
Have we made any sense yet of why Charlie Whitehurst was brought in as the primary backup instead of Ryan Fitzpatrick? Fitzpatrick could have been kept for $3.25 million. Whitehurst comes in. Whitehurst has never done much. Why Whitehurst and not Fitzpatrick?
Well, it's all Ken Whitenhunt. I mean, you know, some decisions are made, and, you know, there's decisions that are made with the group and everybody weighing in. You know, this is pretty clear that, you know, Ken Whitenhunt was with him in San Diego last year. He likes him. They obviously, everyone in the building had some concerns about Ryan Fitzpatrick because of some turnovers he made last season. So the decision to part ways with Ryan Fitzpatrick wasn't necessarily a Whitenhunt decision. I think that was a collective decision made by a lot of people that had been around him. But to pick Whitehurst as the guy to replace Fitzpatrick certainly, is a decision that is easy to question because no one has really seen Whitehurst play other than the people in San Diego who have seen him in practices and maybe seen him in some preseason games. So it's a risk, no question. I will say that just watching him in minicamp, I've been more impressed with him than I thought he would be. He's got a strong arm. He's a big guy. It seems like he knows the offense well because he was with Hunt before. But, if this experiment fails or if something happens to Locker and Whitehurst has to play and it doesn't go so well, it's going to be Whitehurst's fingerprints all over this decision, and he'll be the guy to blame.
Yeah, and Whitehurst's been down this road before with the whole Kevin Cobb situation and all the rookies that didn't work out in Arizona. Jake Locker, the holdover, who appears to be on track to be the starter this year. If not Locker, I don't know who it would be. But the Titans didn't pick up the fifth-year option on Locker's contract. A strange inconsistency there. And what do they really think about Locker if they're not willing to make that extra year commitment, but they're willing to go with him, apparently, as the starter this year?
Well, they definitely are backing Locker, and they definitely have confidence in him, and they like everything about him. And with that said, I mean, I think with the fifth year and not picking up the option, I mean, that strictly became a business decision, and you know how those things work, where they're guaranteed, you know, those contracts and the injuries, those fifth years for those rookies in 2011, those fifth years, if you get injured, they're guaranteed four injury. And with Jake Locker having one season end with a shoulder injury in 2012 and then him coming off a Lisfranc injury that he still was kind of struggling with during the early part of this offseason, you know, if something should have happened to him in 2014 where he has another significant injury, and that's foot. I mean, those Lisfranc injuries, as you know, give some people come back from them fine. Some people, they never really get over them. So let's say something happens to Locker and his whole, not only his 2014 season is wrecked, his 2015 season would be wrecked as well. They'd have been on the hook for, you know, I think it was right at $14 million. They just couldn't afford to do it. They didn't want to take that chance, and they feel like the good faith that they've shown to him throughout his career, that where he's missed so much time, that if he does have a good year, he'll be willing to work with them, you know, as far as a long-term deal after this season. If they have to, they could put, you know, maybe the transition of the franchise tag on him. I think they feel like they still will be in a position to keep him, even though they didn't do it by you know, picking up that fifth-year option.
Is the starting quarterback for Week 1 2015 currently on the roster or not at this point, in your estimation?
I have to say no, because I like Jake Locker, and certainly I hope he does well, because I think he's a good kid. I think he works hard. I'm just a little bit skeptical about whether he can stay healthy or not. I mean, and again, you can't ever, it's hard to predict. I mean, the best way to predict someone's future, I guess, is to look at the past, and he's missed, you know, 14 of 32 starts with injuries. It's one of those deals, I'm going to have to see it to believe it. If he can make it through the season healthy and have a good year, I certainly think he could be the team starting quarterback in 2015 and moving forward. I'm just not sure, so sure he's going to be able to, and I'm not so sure, even if he's able to stay healthy, that this team is going to make the dramatic jump that would result in him getting some kind of a long-term extension where they'd feel confident enough to do it then. So right now I'm a little bit skeptical about it. Certainly a lot of things can happen, but I'd have to say no to answer that question on July 1st.
Every quarterback out there, every team out there, rather, looking for a franchise quarterback if they don't have one. Not many have one. The Titans had one in Steve McNair, and Friday, July 4, will be the five-year anniversary of his murder. Is there still a question in Nashville about whether it all was as neat and tidy as the 20-year-old girlfriend who bought a gun from some guy she worked with who pumped multiple bullets into Steve McNair execution style and then killed herself, even though she'd apparently never had a gun before? Is there any sense that isn't what happened?
Well, I think, I trust, to be honest with you, the Metro Police Department here and their investigation and what they found. I don't think those questions will ever go away, because you've got conspiracy theorists out there, and you've got other people who claim to have knowledge of the workings of the police department and maybe some things that weren't brought out initially. So I don't think you'll ever, just like, you know, some other great mysteries in time, I don't think you'll ever be able to prove to everyone that's the way it went down. But I think being so involved in that story from the day it happened and listening and talking to the people involved and certainly paying attention to the police department and the detectives, those guys, you know, have been doing this for so long. It was very clear to them that it was a murder-suicide, and the way things played out with the girlfriends and other women that were involved in his life and some of the jealousy that was surrounding those individuals, I certainly believe Steve McNair died of a gunshot wound to the head from the woman who ended up killing herself. That's my fault, nothing has come out that has made me even doubt that for a second, to be honest with you.
For a while, it appeared that Vince Young, who had a close relationship with Steve McNair, was going to become the next Steve McNair in Tennessee. Had some initial success, NFL Offensive Rookie of the Year for 2006, but then within a couple of years after that was gone. In hindsight, what happened with Vince Young?
Well, I mean, he got off to a great start here. As everyone remembers, he was an NFL Offensive Rookie of the Year in 2006 and just did things with his athletic ability that even when he maybe wasn't as prepared for games and opponents as he could have been, he just had a way to win games at crunch time. And that carried over in 2007 when he took the team to the playoffs. But eventually some of his bad work habits and him not being committed, I think it caught up to him. And, you know, the locker room during that stretch when he was here was divided. You had a group of guys that were in Vince Young's corner, you know, they were going to support him no matter what. You had another group of guys that saw through some of his stuff and saw, yeah, he was able to win some games on Sundays, but he didn't necessarily work as hard as you should have during the course of the week. And when he started coming up short at other times, they felt like it was because he didn't put the work in. So he kind of divided the locker room by being here. You know, Jeff Fisher was certainly in a tough spot with him and Mike Kammerdinger at the time, having a quarterback who wasn't fully committed, and then having an owner, you know, 600 miles away who wanted this guy to play no matter what. And eventually the whole, all the dynamics that went with him being here, from the locker room being fractured to the coaching staff, ownership not being on the same page, to Vince feeling like he was being mistreated, the whole thing just kind of blew up on him here. And, you know, you got a lot of people, you know, that are Titans fans, that are Vince Young fans, and will be until the end of time. You know, they're going to support him no matter what. But the fact that he left here and has not caught on somewhere else, even as a backup quarterback after his days in Philadelphia, kind of tells you that there was more to it than just a coach who he fell out of favor with. I mean, a lot of the reason Vince Young is on the roster today, I think, is because of Vince Young and because he didn't put the work in during the prime of his career. And now I think he's played his last NFL down, if you ask me. And I think it's sad because he's a guy who had an unbelievable amount of athletic ability, could have been a superstar in this league if he would have put more work in. And I think probably when he looks back at his career one day, he'll have to realize he could have done a heck of a lot more than he did in the pros.
Yeah, he called a shot at one point that he was going to be a Hall of Famer, and nowhere close to that. But, you know, I'm intrigued by the reluctance of players like Vince Young and Tim Tebow to take advantage of opportunities to play in Canada. We have seen quarterbacks who have kick-started their careers or resurrected their careers by playing in Canada. Is it just kind of an arrogance that I'm an NFL quarterback and I don't need to go prove it by playing in Canada? It's hard for me to look at Young and Tebow, who seem to be very different, and come up with a reason why neither guy would want to go to Canada and take advantage of an opportunity to play football and maybe convince someone in the NFL that, hey, we were wrong about this guy. Maybe we should give him a job.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, just seeing Tebow from afar, I've been with him. I've been around at the combine the year he came out. Certainly was around him leading up to games when they played against the Titans. But viewed him from afar. But certainly I was close, you know, I was around Vince Young from the day he arrived in Tennessee in 2006. And if you ask me that question as it relates to Vince Young, I think it's definitely, I hate to use the word arrogance, but I think he feels like the CFL is beneath him and that he would not concede that he's at that level and need to do that. I think he was a star at Texas. Certainly was a story when he first came to the NFL. You know, anybody that remembers his famous 60 Minutes piece, I think during his rookie season, when he pretty much said on there that no one could tell him anything. He's going to do things the way he wants to do it. And no matter how many people tell him that that's probably would be the best career decision, I think he wouldn't be able to humble himself enough to pack up and go to Canada. So I think he would rather retire than admit that that's what he needs to do to get back to the NFL, and that's why I don't think he'll ever do it because of that. I think he's got too many people in his corner too, telling him, "Hey, you're too good for the CFL. You don't need to do this." And he's believed that his whole life, and so he's not about to change now.
There's another rookie quarterback this year who recently said, "I'm not changing for anybody." Johnny Manziel. He was on the board when the Titans used the 11th overall pick. They went tackle Taylor Lewan. He's unsigned. We've heard recently that maybe it has something to do with roster bonuses that Chance Warmack got last year at number 10, but the 11th pick last year, DJ Fluker, didn't. Assuming that Lewan will be signed at some point, where will he play this year? I've seen left tackle, I've seen right tackle, I've seen both. Where do you think he plays?
Yeah, it's going to be one of the great, it's going to be one of the great competitions in camp to figure out how that's going to play out. I won't be very surprised if he's a left tackle, which is his natural position. I think it's where he's going to play starting in 2015. But I just don't think they're going to bump Michael Roos, who's still playing at a high level in the final year of his contract, and have a rookie be the guy primarily responsible for keeping Jake Locker healthy. So I think Roos starts at left tackle, and I think Lewan either starts at right tackle or he is going to come off the bench early in the season while Michael Orr is the starter. I think at some point Lewan works his way into the lineup, but if I had to project a starting lineup for week one, in Kansas City, I think I'd have Roos as the left tackle, Orr as the right tackle, and Lewan as a backup right now, who they'll find a way to get on the field in some capacity. And then maybe if I had to do a depth chart post bye week, maybe you'd see Lewan in there in some capacity, just depending on how guys are playing and how the season's going.
Well, the season may not go very well for the Titans. I don't know what the expectations are. What are the expectations locally? Because I think people look at the Titans and say, it's going to be a couple of years. What's the sense locally of what it'll take to be regarded as a successful season?
Well, I think people feel like they're in a better position from a coaching standpoint. They like what Ken Whitten is playing. I think they feel like they've done a pretty good job with their roster and bringing in some new players. And I think people are optimistic about them, but I still think even the most optimistic fans are not willing to say they're going to be a playoff team yet. They got to see it to believe it. I mean, the team hadn't won a playoff game since 2003. I think probably most people expected 8-8, but knowing that there's like a two-game swing where if they win a couple of games that they're in late, maybe they can get up to 9 or 10 wins. But I think most people think there's somewhere in that window of a 7-win team and maybe a 9-win team. I personally stick at 8-8 until proven otherwise.
I think 8-8 would be a heck of an accomplishment for this specific team, but we'll see how they go. I like Ken Whitten as a coach. The personnel needs to improve. We'll see if they do. Thanks, as always, for some time. We'll talk to you again soon, Jim.
Okay, have a good one. Thanks, Mike.
There is Jim Wyatt of the Tennessee and all things Titans. When we come back, all things you. It's time for you to ask some questions. We've got some via Twitter. We'll have some more, hopefully via phone. But first, you have to pick up your cell phone device or your landline or the tin can and dial 888-237-5269. That number again, 888-237-5269. We'll be right back with PFT Planet. This is PFT Live. PFT Planet time, there's the logo. Next, you'll see the first question, which comes to us, as it always does, via the Twitter from @NickCeglio, possibly Ceglio, possibly Keglio, possibly, but not likely. Are the Giants going to just stay with what they have at tight end? JerMichael Finley, a possibility. I think Finley's a possibility. I think the big question for Finley, and this is the ultimate let's make a deal dilemma. Door number one, $10 million under a disability policy if he never plays again. And his agent, Blake Barrett, who was on the program several weeks ago, seemed to create the impression that if he just chooses not to play, even if he's been cleared, if Finley chooses not to play, he still gets the money, which I don't know of many insurance companies that would be so willing to hand out $10 million. But let's assume that's accurate. $10 million if you choose not to play. How much do you make if you choose to play? And accept the risk of further injury. Accept the risk of further neck injury or other body part injury and not make $10 million after taxes. To make $10 million after taxes, depending upon what state you're playing in, you may have to make up to $20 million in California before taxes. So you just take the $10 million and move on? I'd sure be tempted to do that, but he has to ask himself, do I hang him up? And it could just be he needs the time to come to that decision on his own. But the Giants, a viable candidate if Finley decides to play, especially because here's what they have at tight end. Kellen Davis, Larry Donald, Daniel Fells, Xavier Grimble, who sounds like he's either from a Harry Potter novel or a Dickens novel for the older folks in the crowd, Xavier Grimble, and Adrian Robinson. So, yeah, they need help at tight end. And Finley makes sense. A trade would make sense if there's someone who wants to make a trade. But they need help at the position if they want to improve. They need help at plenty of positions if they want to improve. Let's go to the phone lines. Russell in West Virginia. We don't get many calls from West Virginia. Maybe this really is that tin can that I talk about from time to time. Russell, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, Russell.
Hey, Russell. Hey, how's it going? I'm actually from Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, okay. Rich, well, close enough.
No, yeah. I wouldn't say that, but all right. My question was, I follow Pro Football Sports Talk closely, and I follow your writers closely. And specifically, I follow Evan Stiva because I enjoy his fantasy opinion. But he's always spoken extremely demonstratively about the team y'all just talked about, the Tennessee Titans. And Mr. Florio, I can't seem to recall you talking about him much, but I was curious if your opinion was as demonstrative that they were fielding the worst NFL roster in the NFL.
Well, thank you for your call, Russell in Richmond, Virginia. And, you know, when I travel, I'll tell people I'm from West Virginia, and they'll say, well, I've been to Virginia. And I'll say, well, I've been to Virginia, too. I don't live there. I live in West Virginia. And apparently, we got so excited by the possibility of someone from West Virginia calling a program in West Virginia that we got it wrong. So it's fitting that it's ironic, as they would say, whether that word works there or not. Anyway, the question was, do I share the same opinion as Evan Silva, who currently doesn't write for PFT, writes for Roto World, but I'll field this one anyway. I don't think the Titans have the worst roster in the NFL right now. I think the Raiders have the worst roster in the NFL right now, especially in light of their schedule this year. I think the Raiders will be the worst team. I think of all the teams out there where you can connect the dots at 0-0 and say, that team has a chance to get to the playoffs. That team has a chance. Raiders, no. If it happens this year, it'll be the best thing that ever happens for the NFL, because it will be proof that in any given year, any given team, no matter how bad that team looks, could make it to the postseason. I would be shocked if the Raiders make it. You know what? The more I say this, the more I'm thinking, holy crap, they're going to make the playoffs, and I'm going to be eating these words for time to come. But I'm not saying they definitely won't. I'm saying of all the teams in the NFL, I'd say that it would be the most shocking if the Raiders make it. And as of right now, they've got the longest shot and necessarily the worst roster. Back to the Twitter thing at Brian Palmese or Palmese or some other potential pronunciation. How long will Sean McDermott last in Carolina? If Panthers defense maintains its success, McDermott should be a top head coaching list for 2015. I'm surprised McDermott didn't get more buzz this year. I think what happens is when the head coach has a background on one side of the ball, that coordinator, when that team is successful, seems to have a harder time getting himself into the pipeline. Now, that wasn't the case for Eric Mangini in New England with Bill Belichick, but usually it's harder if you've got a defensive head coach for the defensive coordinator to get the credit he deserves, because the thinking is the defense is good because of the head coach, not because of the defensive coordinator. But McDermott, a guy who was fired in Philadelphia because he was having trouble living up to the considerable shadow of the late Jim Johnson. McDermott has done well for himself in Carolina. That defense should be good again. I know there's concerns about the secondary. If the pass rush can bring it, I don't care who's playing corner and safety. If the pass rush is stifling, anybody can just sit back there and wait for the ball to get spurted up into the air, as it will from time to time when Charles Johnson or Greg Hardy or someone else is laying the hammer on the opposing quarterback. Next up, here we go. John in Portland, welcome back to the program. What's up, John?
Hi, Mike. I was just wondering if there's any new news about the painkiller lawsuits and where you see that ending up. Do you think the case will be tossed or dropped, or will there be a settlement? I don't really see this being as big a deal as the concussion lawsuits. What do you think?
Well, the painkiller lawsuit, you know, here's what happens. A lawsuit gets filed, and then there's an extended period of time where the defendants have an opportunity to respond, and the lawyers routinely will give each other the courtesy of extra time to respond. I'm assuming at some point a motion to dismiss will be filed in this painkiller lawsuit, claiming that any gripes, any disputes, any claims should be made through the arbitration process created by the labor deal between the NFL and the NFLPA. Same argument that we saw in the concussion case, and that argument's still pending now. That's where the decision was made to try to settle the case before the judge in Philadelphia ruled on whether or not the case should even be in court. That'll be the first line of defense for the NFL. And if the players can get past that, and there's one donut hole of players from 87 to 92 where there was no CBA, where there is no labor deal that they could have filed an arbitration claim under, that window of players should survive. And even then, there's an argument to be made that the cases should go to court. But if it does go to court, I think there's a bigger problem for the NFL here than in the concussion cases, because if you've got doctors who are disseminating prescription medication without providing information to their patients of the risks, I haven't done the research, but I'd be willing to wager a considerable sum of money if I were a wagering man that by not providing the information about the risks, the doctor necessarily has violated some federal regulation or law that would give someone grounds for a lawsuit going forward. And I think that is the much bigger weakness for the NFL in the painkiller lawsuit than in the concussion lawsuit. But we've seen the painkiller lawsuit get a lot more coverage right out of the gates. I think the concussion lawsuits have blazed the trail. Here comes the painkiller lawsuit and its morning news shows, its mainstream media network news, 6:30 p.m. or whenever they have network news. Does anybody even watch network news anymore? They still have it. And the fact that it's making it into those types of avenues tells me that people are paying attention to it, but I think it's going to be the same kind of problems and challenges that the players are having in the concussion cases. But you know what? They're settling the concussion cases. Maybe the painkiller lawsuit gets settled before it gets very far. One more question from the day. Malachi or Malachi, I hope I'm right with one of those two, in Las Vegas. You're on PFT Live. What's up?
Hey, Mike. It's Malachi. You got it right first time.
I should have quit while I was ahead.
I was wondering, if Jimmy Graham were to win his arbitration case post July 15th, what are the salary cap ramifications going forward?
Well, and here's how it works. And it's a great question, because folks think that the issue is resolved this week when the initial ruling is issued by an arbitrator. And it's not. This week, what will happen is an arbitrator will issue an initial decision on whether or not Graham, who currently counts for $7 million under the New Orleans Saints salary cap, whether he's a tight end or a receiver for tag purposes, subject to appeal. Now, I haven't asked the league this question, but I'm going to as soon as we finish today. I assume the answer is it remains $7 million until the appeal process is finalized. And the appeal process may or may not be finalized by July 15. And that's the thing. If this all gets finalized after July 15 or whenever it's finalized, if Graham wins, another $5.3 million hits the Saints cap immediately. I'm assuming they'd have an opportunity to rescind the franchise tag if they choose to do so. I doubt that they would do that. And if I'm Jimmy Graham, I am signing that thing as quickly as possible at $12.3 million for 1 year. But yeah, $5.3 million would hit the cap. My assumption is it hits the cap as soon as the decision becomes final. And it won't be final on Thursday. It's going to give somebody a lot of leverage in the negotiations that inevitably will occur before July 15. That's the last day to do a multi-year deal. But it's not going to be final probably until after that. And you know, if Graham loses and then Graham says, I'd like an expedited appeal, I'd like to get this resolved by July 15, if I'm the three-person appeal panel, I say, hey, Jimmy, you should have filed your grievance at the appropriate time, right out of the gates. You wait until the end of April. This is the way it plays out. So now if the Saints lose, maybe they can convince the appeal panel to give them an expedited ruling. But a lot would have to happen quickly, especially with the ruling expected Thursday. That's July 3. That's 12 days to turn it all around and then negotiate a contract based on what the outcome of the grievance is. So a lot of questions pending, issues hovering, and ramifications going forward for other tight ends who maybe line up in the slot or split wide more than half the time. We are done. That's all the time for today's program. That's the segue I was searching for. You may have seen the wheels spinning in my head or not, if there are wheels in there. You'll get to see the wheels spin at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time tonight or not. Pro Football Talk. We are closing in on our summer hiatus, but we will be on. And I know the soccer match is on. It's a match, right? Soccer match. Two screens, right? You can watch soccer online. You can watch us live. You can do the little corner. I mean, and if the game, I mean, we may be losing 2-0 by then or winning 2-0 by then. So you can find a way. DVR, right? There's all sorts of technologies available. We're doing the prime numbers tonight. 7, 31, 71, 15, 73. I think that's all of them. 7 and 73, you can vote on both of those. All-time greats. 7, good luck. 73, some pretty good players too. Vote now. The results will be announced tonight during the program. We hope you'll watch us either live or on DVR. We hope you watch us tomorrow. We'll be back. Tomorrow is the last PFT Live before our 3-plus week hiatus, so you'll want to catch it. You'll want to call us. You'll want to take advantage of the last opportunity to ask me questions I don't know how to answer. You can check us out around the clock throughout the 3-week hiatus at profootballtalk.com. Have a great one. See you back here tomorrow.